Well, good afternoon, Juneau. It's seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, I'll be hosting today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have a great lineup of guests. You just heard that announcement about the Friends of Admiralty annual meeting. Well, Joel Burnett and KJ Metcalf will be here to tell us more about that in just a few moments after National Native News. The folks from Perseverance Theater will be here to tell us a little bit about their new comedy performance coming up seminar. The JWAC people, Juneau World Affairs Council, are doing China in the 21st Century. It's called The Pivot and the Sail. It's Friday and Saturday at UAS Egan Lecture Hall, and Jim Clark will drop in to give us details on that. And Giselle Stone will be here later in the program to tell us about the elementary art program in the schools. Weather looks like, well, sunny, and highs around 40, and southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour, and it looks like we're going to get that tomorrow, and it looks like we're going to get that probably Wednesday, and then Wednesday afternoon it turns partly cloudy, and then Thursday night it turns mostly cloudy, and Friday it's mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, and like that. So it's away from Juneau for a little while in the sun, and then we'll have Juneau back come Friday. National Native News is next. Stay tuned for our next guest after that.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country are in Washington, D.C. this week to address issues facing their communities. They're meeting with cabinet secretaries and members of Congress. Healthcare is among priorities. The Department of Health and Human Services is holding a tribal budget consultation and Tribal Resource Day. Tara Branson is with the National Congress of American Indians.
So a lot of the discussion is about providing adequate resources for the Indian Health Service. It also lately has been about ACA implementation and the prevention provisions that are included in the Affordable Care Act. Tribal leaders often highlight the need for extended or adequate funding for TANF and for child welfare policies and programs that they run in their communities. It's anything that a tribal leader really wants to come and have an HHS official hear from them.
One-on-one meetings between tribes and health officials are also scheduled. Branson discussed the meetings on the talk show Native America Calling. The Native American Journalists Association is supporting the Navajo Nation in its request for an apology from CBS for dialogue in a recent television show. On Mike and Molly, a joke was made about Arizona being nothing but a furnace full of drunk Indians. NAJA President Rhonda Lavaldo says the comment to a nationwide audience is offensive and promotes stereotypes about Native people.
To be, you know, told this, that all the, you know, all the Natives in Arizona are drunks, you know, that just imprints in their mind, okay, that's what they are. And so then we have to go back out and re-educate people and say, no, this is wrong. And so it's just a stereotype that Native people shouldn't have to put up with, especially now. You would think that somebody would have said, you know, something.
NAJA is encouraging screenwriters unfamiliar with Native people to contact them with questions. The Navajo Nation is one of more than 20 tribes in the state. CBS has declined to comment to news outlets about the joke. A film that celebrates how a Cherokee community came together to bring water to its residents is now in national release. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, the movie premiered this week in the nation's capital.
The screening of The Cherokee Word for Water in Washington, D.C. is part of the national celebration of Women's History Month. The movie chronicles how traditional Native American values of reciprocity and interdependence were central to the Bell Waterline Project. That project in the 1980s led to Wilma Mankiller becoming the first modern female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. Before her death in 2010, Mankiller talked about the production for the movie's website.
My hope is that we'll bring it to a global audience and that people seeing the film someplace in some community, somewhere on the planet, will sit there and look at the people in our film and say, you know, we can do that. If they did that, we can do that.
Mankiller and Charlie Soap, who is a producer of the movie and was Mankiller's husband, led volunteers in rural eastern Oklahoma to construct the 16-mile pipeline that brought fresh water to their community. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
In Canada, the Public Safety Minister announced Monday funding for First Nations policing programs will be renewed for 5 years. According to the CBC, the more than $100 million a year program pays roughly half the cost of policing in about 400 Aboriginal communities. It was set to expire at the end of March. First Nations leaders expressed concern, saying public safety would be compromised. On this day in 1980, Jay Silverheels, who played Tonto in the television series The Lone Ranger, passed away in Los Angeles, California at the age of 67. He was from the Six Nations Reserve in Canada. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
It's 3:30. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first guest is here to tell us about a day-long seminar that will be on Saturday. It's called the, I guess you're calling it the Brown Bear Forum this year?
Well, right. It's really part of the Friends of Admiralty annual meeting. So we have a business meeting, very short, starts at 1 o'clock.
This is KJ Metcalf speaking.
Yeah, to and this is at DIPAC Hatchery in here in Juneau this Saturday. So the forum starts at 3 o'clock and goes to 5 o'clock, and we're looking at a number of issues on brown bears on Unit 4, which Admiralty is part of. Unit 4 is the fish and game designation for Admiralty Baranoff and Chichagof Island. And so we think there's some issues with the number of bears that are being hunted, and we would like to see fish and game take another look at the bear population, and it's been a number of years since it was estimated. And there's a number of new techniques that fish and game has for updating populations, including hair snares, which they can do a DNA analysis on. It's simply a barbed wire wrap around a tree that the bears love to scratch on. And so they pull the hair off of those and can do a DNA analysis and determine the sex and the different individuals of bears. And you couple that with a trail camera that's triggered by movement. So not only have they put collars on bears and then tracked them and then recaptured them, but now they can kind of broaden that database by new techniques. So it's a really fine opportunity for folks to come and listen to a bear biologist, a bear guide, outfitter guides who specialize in viewing bears. Just talk about the bears that they see, where they see them, and talking about the need to do additional research and data collection. And then that'll be followed by a potluck supper, which is always tremendous. And that'll be at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. And then at 7 o'clock, John
Shane. I'm assuming you will not be serving a bear main course.
No, no, we won't.
Okay.
That's not on the menu. And then the evening speaker is John Shane, and he's one of the premier biologists in Alaska. He spent a number of years in southeast Alaska working on Admiralty with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And then he moved to Anchorage, where he was a research biologist with Audubon. And he's now retired, and he's writing books and giving lectures. So he loves Admiralty Island, and he has a passion about it. So he's going to share some photos and experiences and some of his memories of Admiralty that evening. So it should be a terrific all-day event starting at really 3 o'clock with the Bear Forum.
John Shane has a title of Science Advisor Emeritus still with Audubon Alaska. So evidently he does some of his speaking as an official of the Audubon
Society. Right, yeah, he's still connected with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what a nice opportunity to catch up on this wonderful piece of nature that's within reach of Juneau.
Right. You know, Admiralty Island is an amazing island. It's almost a million acres. And it turns out that it is now the largest reserve of intact, that's unlogged, unroaded country that represents what was formerly the extensive temperate rainforest that started in Northern California, came up the Oregon-Washington coast, BC coast, and through southeast Alaska. So all of the rest of that area has been logged or developed in some way. So Admiralty is an amazing opportunity for research and bear viewing and wilderness experience left out of all these millions of acres that once existed.
How do people get access to Admiralty Island?
Well, if you go to Angoon, you can go by ferry or you can fly.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, you have to take some kind of watercraft to get yourself there. There are some guides that will specialize in flying you into some areas, like Pack Creek is a world premier bear viewing opportunity, and that gets a lot of use in the summer. And there's planes that ferry people over there all the time as well as guide them.
Now, KJ, there's a huge mining operation up on one end of Admiralty Island now. How is that working with the unspoiled nature of the island?
Well, that's a work in progress, I guess. And it was kind of grandfathered in, was discovered well before the island was made a national monument. So
which happened when? When was it made the national monument?
In 1978.
Okay.
Jimmy Carter proclaimed it first as a national monument under his authority using the Antiquities Act. And then in 1980, it was included in Anilka as a national monument wilderness. And so the Hecla mine, the Greens Creek mine, is an important part of the economy of the local area, but it's also it's a concern because of the amount of toxins that it produces, and it's produced something like 94 million pounds of toxins that are in the tailings. And so it's kind of how those tailings are treated. And the fact that the Forest Service says the tailings will have to be monitored and treated. When I say treated, the water that runs through them goes through a treatment plant forever. And so you wonder, well, how long is forever, and who's going to do that, and who's going to pay for it? So it's an incredible opportunity for revenue and jobs for folks in Juneau, but it also comes with a price. And so Friends of Admiralty, one of our tasks, I think, is to try and make it as clean a mine as possible. And so that's what we're working on.
And will that be discussed at the event on Saturday?
Probably tangentially. Mm-hmm. It's not a main point of discussion right now. The Forest Service is doing an environmental impact statement on the expansion of the tailings pile, and that's a major issue.
What's the relationship between Friends of Admiralty and the Forest Service? Do you are you guys handshaking?
Yeah. Okay. We work very closely with the Forest Service. In fact, I started off my career, or ended my career, I might say, as the first ranger on Admiralty when it was made a national monument, and I retired from the Forest Service in 1982. And so I've, admired their ability to deal with the issues on Admiralty and work with Angoon and work with the mine. So they don't have an easy job, but they have some very good people.
Well, if folks have an interest in Admiralty and they want to come to the meeting, this is open to the public.
Absolutely.
Right, and it starts at 1 o'clock with a business meeting. The forum itself sets off at 3 o'clock. It lasts until roughly 5, and then once it's over, you'll have the potluck dinner, and then John Shane is speaking at 7:30.
Correct.
Evening program. And all of this takes place at DIPAC this weekend.
Yes.
Now, there's an opportunity, I think, to see, not actually go there, but to see part of Admiralty from a ship that you're chartering in May.
Right.
Is that right?
This last year we chartered a ship and a catamaran and went to Hawk Inlet and looked at the mine stealing and had some of the Hawk elders, Hawk Village elder folks on board, and they talked about their historic and ancient history with Hawk Inlet. And so that was such a success that we decided we would take another spring trip, and that's May 11th on a Saturday, and we will go to Thunder Bay. And that was a relocation center for the Aleuts during World War II, and not a bright spot in our the way we treated our First Nations people. But Father Alexa, who many folks know, will be with us, and he has worked with the Aleut people and talk about their time at the old cannery site there. And then from there we'll go to Young's Bay, Admiralty Cove, and we'll have some Auk elders who will talk about that traditional and very ancient village site and fort site. So it's kind of a drive-by viewing thing. You don't get off the boat, but we see some incredible wildlife, some wonderful sea mammals and birds, and makes a great day. So we sold out in a couple of days last year, and the tickets have just gone on sale, so I urge folks to get them early, $45.
And where do you get them?
Well, you can get them at Hearthside, at Rainy Retreat Books, and at the Jack Building, or online.
KJ, good luck with your seminar this weekend. It again starts at 1 o'clock with the business meeting, and then there's a 3 o'clock forum and a potluck dinner at 6, and 7:30 that evening is John Shane talking about his reminiscences of working on Admiralty. All of this is the Friends of the Admiralty annual meeting Brown Bear Forum coming up this Saturday. And if you want to go on the cruise, you ought to buy tickets from either the Jack or Hearthside right now, because it'll sell out in the next couple of days probably.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.
I went to his room in the middle of the night. I tiptoed inside and I turned on the light. But to my dismay, he was nowhere in sight. And I'm sure Uncle Walter went waltzing that night. He goes, wah, 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 wah. Walter won't do, so he can go waltzing, wah, wah, waltzing. He can go waltzing with bears. Mom bought Uncle Walter a new suit to wear, but when he comes in, it's all covered with hair. And lately I've noticed there's several new goes wah, 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 waltzing with bears. Raggy bears, shaggy bears, baggy bears too. And there's nothing on earth Uncle Walter won't do. So he can go waltzing, wah, 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 waltzing. He can go waltzing with bears. I told Uncle Walter that he should be good and do all the things I said that he should, but I know that he'd rather be off in the woods, and I'm afraid that I'll lose him for good.
Well, we can't guarantee you'll be off in the woods, but if you happen to come by DIPAC this Saturday, you can attend the wonderful Brown Bear Forum that's being put on by the Friends of Admiralty Island. The event starts at 1 o'clock with a business meeting and then lasts until, with the forum lasts until dinner at 6 o'clock, and it's a potluck dinner, so bring a dish. And at 7:30, John Shane is going to be coming in to talk about his reminiscences as working on Admiralty Island. He's with the Audubon Society as an emeritus scientist advisor. Right now, we have some people who've come out of the woods to talk to us. Art Roach is here, along with Cynthia Crute, and they are actually on stage right now with a comedy opening at Perseverance Theater, I guess with a preview opening last week or Sunday. And this play is called Seminars. The play was on Broadway recently, or 2012 was when it closed on Broadway. So can you give us, without too much of a spoiler, can you give us an idea of what we're going to see?
Sure. It's a comedy about a great teacher who is brought in to work with some really accomplished students who are really at the height of their skills, and they're all potential writers, and they all have good reason to believe, based on what they've done in the past, that they could have careers as writers. So they hire this really high-end guy to work with them in this intimate seminar, and he tells them the truth about what their careers will be like, and then they have to deal with it.
Cynthia, did he just tell the truth?
Or? He absolutely did. He absolutely did. Yeah, I mean, I think that this character, Leonard, the great teacher, comes in and tells them the truth about their potential, and in a way that speaks to who they are as people as well. So it's kind of a coming-of-age story a little bit, sort of in the tradition of the great teaching stories like Good Will Hunting or Educating Rita or the Dead Poets Society.
Now, Leonard, who is the advisory writer, the master writer who runs the seminars, was played by two different people on Broadway, very differently.
Yes.
Alan Rickman played him as a somewhat dark character, really. Mm-hmm. And then Jeff Goldblum took over the part and closed the show out. But his interpretation of Leonard was much more of a sleazeball than perhaps the kind of darkness with the same lines and the same moves, but two very, very different ways of seeing this. So I'm wondering, first of all, who's actually playing Leonard in presentation?
Yeah, we have the wonderful Boston Christopher, who will, you know, I think that one of the things about great writing and great plays is that each actor who enters the role makes it really their own. And Boston brings to it both sort of these heights of intellectual acumen, real smart, bracing, cutting sort of commentary on what's happening in the play, and also real humanity and just terrific humor. He's very, very funny on stage.
One of the things I will never forget about Boston was in Of Mice and Men. After the final bow, he walked off as his character. He never changed that droop that he did. Now, he's got good posture. He's a good-looking guy walking down the street, but he had that guy on, and he never took him off. I don't know if he even spoke to people in the dressing room in his own voice. Anyway, so
he's a terrific actor.
Yeah, he is. And so here's a character that he can get his teeth into.
Of Mice and Men, he and Kevin T. Bennett, who played George with him, they were old friends.
Yeah, they'd wanted to play this piece.
They'd gone to college together, and they had that relationship. And you could see it in the curtain call, I think, and that it sort of played all the way out. And I think in this one, Teresa Rebeck, who wrote Seminar, she was quoted as saying that she had, as she got into it, you can help me with the quote, she said that she had discovered she wrote a play where a master actor could undress four younger actors on stage in front of an audience every night. And that's kind of the relationship Boston has with these younger actors, too. He's a real leader in our company, and he takes them to school.
And it's funny.
It's very funny.
Yeah. So, and comedy is, you guys kind of have to reach to comedy. You don't put it in every year, every time. I guess you always put one in, but you only do like one out of it.
Try to find one, and sometimes they're smart, and sometimes they're new, and sometimes they're, it just depends. We only get five a year, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish we could do more, because we'd have more.
I know, if you had six, you could do two comedies.
Six,
and
exactly.
I'll tell you, I go to these and howl. I'm on the floor up there, three rows back, or in the front row if I can get those seats down front, because they're always wonderful. I have fond memories of some of the wonderful comedies you played in the past. Yeah. So when you decided to take this on, how much are you affected by the Broadway production? Do you?
Yeah, well, I didn't see it. I talked to my I have some students back in Pittsburgh who I work with, and I talked to them about how if you see a production too close to when you're going to stage it yourself, you get imprinted with it, right? Mm-hmm. And you get kind of stuck in that vision
of it.
Happens
with movies too, that you
absolutely
of the place. Yeah.
Like you can't read the book right before you see the film, or you're going to spoil your your experience.
Yeah.
And so that. I certainly didn't see them, but I did read some reviews, actually, which I find illuminating because you get to see what a particular reviewer thinks is the important theme in a play, for instance, or particular strengths or particular failings inside of a performance. And that, for me, is stimulating, makes me think creatively about, well, how will I attack these things and what will these things, how much will they come to the fore in our production?
So did you find negative reviews?
I didn't really.
Really?
No,
huh.
I didn't.
The ones I read, the reviews I read were very upbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of looking for one where somebody didn't like the play, because it seems to me you could learn a great deal about the play in retrospect from a negative review.
Well, Rebecca is a terrific writer. She's just so smart. And, you know, she's the originators of Smash, that television series. And you can tell her dialogue just crackles. It's so enjoyable. And as well, she's just got a terrific plot. So I don't think there are too many things to bemoan in the text, unless you don't have, you know, a strong production, which obviously they have had very strong productions.
Well, this play opened November 20th, 2011, and closed May 6th, 2012. Is that a normal run for Broadway?
I think what happens sometimes, I don't know, really, to speak authoritatively about it.
Can you chime in?
But they had stars in it,
they
right?
Did,
who have
yeah.
other they have other obligations.
Okay.
So Alan Rickman had to be replaced by Jeff Goldblum,
yeah.
who would have ended his engagement. And it's likely, you know, going into the summer, maybe the sales were projected to be a little bit lower. That's not historically a great time of year. So if they couldn't find another name, they probably decided that they'd made enough money on it and cut it. But I think that it's considered a successful run for a small drama or a small comedy like this that's non-musical to run for 6 months. That's not bad.
Mm.
And I think it did well, and they were well-reviewed, as you say. It was considered a pretty big success on Broadway. And the timing of it, we were lucky because we were still looking for that fifth title for our season, and it closed and became available to regionals like us, and we called them. We were one of the first calls. And Seth at Washington Square Artists, who represents it, said, absolutely, you can have it.
Okay, so you're getting into the next question that I wanted to, which is some of the details of how you get a play like this.
Mm-hmm.
So you deal with, like, agencies that hold the properties that you're interested in?
Right. It depends a little on the play, but something like Seminar, which was just being published last spring, and we had to get a copy to read. We had heard of it, of course, and knew some people who'd seen it, and it seemed to fit the bill for what we were looking for. But I had to figure out who represented it, which is not that hard. Teresa's pretty well known, and then, you know, I've known him professionally for a long time. So I said, hey, can I get a script to read? And we passed it around, and it just seemed
to
like
you?
A good choice.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
You were part of the first read?
I don't know if I was a part of the first read, but I was certainly part of it as we considered it more strongly.
So did you just dive right in, or did somebody say, do you want to direct this?
A funny circle around for this, because Cindy's been here before. This is her second production at Perseverance. The first one goes back to when Peter Dubois was here, and
mm-hmm.
it was really great, and we worked together on that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about another play, which dropped off the table for various reasons. I can't even remember what they all were now. We'll probably do it. I think we wanted to go to Anchorage and realized that we were full up on the Anchorage offerings. So this was a show. This show won't go up to Anchorage. So then we were looking to replace that title with something else, and we had a bunch of them that we were batting around, and the Seminar, it just rose to the top. So we actually had the director already, and then we're just looking for the right fit with the company and the director and the theater. So.
There's five people in the cast. Who else?
Meredith Hinckley-Schmidt.
What else have we seen these people in?
What else have we seen these people in?
This is Meredith's first, and
okay.
She's terrific. She's a friend of many friends. I've actually wanted her here for a long time. She's from Skagway, works at the Red Onion in the summer. She's very funny, very
uh-huh.
good actress. She's good friends with Allison Holtkamp, who's playing Izzy. So they're the two women in the class. They're both terrific. Allison was first in Leading Lady, speaking of comedy. She's a very funny lady. She was just played Ado Annie in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Terrific, terrific actress. And then the young men are Enrique Bravo, who's a real favorite, funny guy. He does a lot of singing for us. But and he's terrific. Well, they're all good.
They're all good.
And Corin Hughes-Scandes, who was just in Of Mice and Men, he played Carlson.
So, oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, another perseverance on the boards here for us all to lap up and enjoy. When can we do it?
We open Friday at 7:30. We run for 4 weekends, so we close on March 31st. There's a matinee on the 31st. All the other performances are at 7:30, and we run Thursdays through Sundays. And the tickets are at perseverancetheater.org, the JAHC.org, or you can pick them up at the usual outlets, Hearthside Books or at the Jack, or go to perseverancetheater.org and order them online.
And a note about that, if you are picking up tickets, there are diagrams of the seating.
Right.
And it pays to get get early, because that way you get the better seats.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, where do you think the best seats are in your little house?
I think they're all pretty good, but I would... If the seats are available, I would stay towards the center, away from the walls.
Center section, and maybe back about 3-4 rows or so. Otherwise, you get actors who have to take a short step in order to keep them trotting on your foot.
You might get some pages in your lap.
I absolutely love the front row because it's like being in the play. You know?
It's pretty fun for this one.
Matter of fact, I was on stage once. You had seating for the play on the Sitka History.
Oh, right.
And you actually had, you'd done theater in the round.
You had one of those.
And,
those
I was up on stage. So it was a great place to be. I really enjoyed it. Well, break a leg. Good
Thank
luck
you.
With this show. I think you guys do comedy so wonderfully, and that little arena over there for a 5-person cast is just exactly perfect for the size you're doing. Thanks for coming up and directing for us.
Thank you very much for having us here today.
Thank you, Lynn.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 5th of March, 2013. It's the birthday of Lady Gregory, born Isabella Augusta Paris on this day in 1852 in County Tipperary, Ireland, an early patron of William Butler Yeats and his most loyal friend, along with him one of the founders of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin. She owned the estate in Cool in County Galway in Western Ireland, where Yeats wrote a number of his poems, including The Wild Swans at Cool, which begins, "The trees are in their autumn beauty, the woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky. Upon the brimming water, among the stones, are 59 swans." It was on this day in 1975 that the Home Brew Computer Club first met in a garage near Menlo Park in Silicon Valley. 1975, computers were not for personal use. They were gigantic, could take up an entire room, could cost about $1 million apiece. Among the early members of the Homebrew Computer Club were high school friends Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who designed the Apple I and the Apple II to bring down to the Homebrew Computer Club and show it off. It's the birthday of the novelist Leslie Marmon Silco, born Albuquerque, 1948, grew up in the Laguna Pueblo Reservation, went to law school, but she quit after she read Charles Dickens's Bleak House. She said, "The law has nothing to do with justice, and injustice can't be left unchallenged. So I decided to be a writer. Writing can't change the world overnight, but writing may have an enormous effect over time, over the long haul." Best known for her novel Ceremony, story of a Laguna man named Tayo, who comes home to the reservation after surviving World War II and the Bataan Death March. Here's a poem by Carl Dennis entitled String Quartet. "Art and life, I wouldn't want to confuse them, but it's hard to hear this quartet without comparing it to a conversation of the quiet kind, where no one tries to outtalk the other participants, where each is eager instead to share in the task of moving the theme along from the opening statement to the final bar. A conversation that isn't likely to flourish when sales technicians come trolling for customers, office holders for votes, preachers for converts. Many good people among such talkers, but none engaged like the voices of the quartet in resisting the plots time hatches to make them unequal, to set them at odds, to pull them asunder. I love the movement where the cello is occupied with repeating a single phrase, while the others strike out on their own three separate journeys that seem to suggest each prefers, after all, the pain and pleasure of playing solo. But no, each, near the end, swerves back to the path their friend has been plodding, and he receives them as if he never once suspected their loyalty. Would I be moved if I thought the music belonged to a world remote from this one, if it didn't seem instead to be making the point that conversation like this is available at moments sufficiently free and self-forgetful, and at other moments maybe there's still a chance to participate in the silence of listeners who are glad for what they manage to bring to the music and for what they manage to take away. A poem by Carl Dennis, String Quartet, from Unknown Friends, published by Penguin, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, whose Reputation Defender service is designed to help businesses and professionals improve their search results. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 24 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is here to tell us about... Well, she's here to tell us about those things that you walk through the Nugget Mall about this time of year, and you see all of these things that children have drawn in the schools. And if you just walk past them on your way to the store, you're making a mistake. Mm-hmm. Because this is a town of amazing arts capability, and the kids are the start of it all. So, Giselle Stone, tell us what you've been doing and how this all works up and like that.
Well, this spring I've been working with Nancy Lanehart in the Juneau School District Art Department. She is actually running it now herself as of this year, and so hired me on basically as a helper to organize kits, art kits, which go around to the elementary schools. And through that, I actually got asked to organize and help put together this all-city, district-wide elementary art show, which has happened the past couple of years in the Nugget Mall. It's been a huge success, really wonderful for the kids to actually get to see their art put up in a very public space. And unfortunately, this year, this fall, one of the positions was cut, so there was two full-time art teachers, and now it's just Nancy. And so the idea of this huge production was not possible. And the Women of the Moose in town, chapter 439, decided that this fall they would fundraise to make it possible again, this one-year reprieve. And they found me, which was pretty miraculous, but I actually have experience in this realm, not only because I'm an artist and put up my own shows, but I went through the art program at UAF up in Fairbanks and actually helped the elementary art program up there put together their district-wide art show. So I had quite a bit of experience doing that, and so have been working pretty hard to gather children's art for the last month. And it will be starting and be up on March 11th, this Monday. And it's going to be running all the way through March 28th at the Nugget Mall.
So the art that we see comes out of art education classes in the schools.
Yes. Most of the art that you will see this year, they either come from just work that the students have been doing in their classroom that maybe a teacher noticed that the student was excelling. And so it might be a personal work. It might be an actual piece of work from an art kit lesson, which are probably most of them that you'll see. You'll see repetitive works that look similar but are obviously from a different student, and those are from the art kit. So a teacher can rent out these kits, kind of like a library system. They rent out these art kits that are developed by the elementary art teachers, which this year is Nancy, and they do this as a class and produce similar products. And so that's one of the other places that most of this artwork is probably drawn from is those art kits. And some teachers actually venture out on their own and create their own art projects, and you'll see those as well.
Who actually makes the selections as to which get shown?
This year I chose to have the teachers select, and it has been true in the past years. Each teacher decides after, you know, a period of time, one or two students that actually can, that they feel are kind of excelling in that area or having some level of creativity that's really wonderful and a piece to show that's really wonderful. And then they submitted it to me, and that's how it worked this year and has been in the past couple of years.
And then it's your job really to organize the show so that as to how it goes up and like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so the Women of the Moose basically asked me here in town, asked me if I could organize it and put it together and basically do the grunt work. So I've been running around collecting artwork and preparing to set this show up on Monday. So. And it will be up for two whole weeks, which is pretty nice to have that up. And it's just in the halls of the mall, so it's pretty easy to walk by and to glance and see some of those pieces of work that are really wonderful.
How do I say this? How much can you add to the visual impact of a piece of art by choosing where it goes in the display?
That's a good question. A lot, actually. Setting up a gallery space is a tremendous amount of work. It definitely takes an aesthetic eye that's used to seeing artwork up in a space, understanding about how people view things and where their eye sees it on a wall can give importance to the piece. So if a piece is at eye level, we like to say directly at eye level. Usually it's like an average eye level is where pieces are hung in a traditional gallery. Mm-hmm. And it just makes a huge impact. Also, if you give it more space and place it next to other pieces of work, it can change the way a piece of art looks. So if there's a piece of art that's really vibrant colors and then it has two other pieces with just as equally vibrant colors on either side, they can kind of drown each other out. Mm. But if you choose a piece that has vibrant colors and you put it in the middle of a space and then you surround those with pieces that complement it rather than challenge it, that can make a huge difference in how a gallery space is put up. And obviously this poses a unique challenge in that it's a mall and we're putting up walls. If anybody's seen it before, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But basically putting up wooden walls that get set up in a zigzag
pattern.
Kind of
like accordion.
Yeah, like an accordion fold.
Yeah.
And so when you're that's a whole other thing to consider is it's not like a white space. You're also working in a mall that has a lot of other colors. And mm-hmm. You're working on wood. So there's that also gives a challenge to actually setting up artwork. But the artwork that I've been collecting has such variety that it's really exciting to kind of think about how to throw everything together and make everything complement each other.
So the next question is, does this spill over doing this in Fairbanks and here?
Mm-hmm.
Does this spill over when you do a show of yourself, of your own? I mean, how much of this do you use when you're arranging a show, say for a first Friday or something?
Oh yeah, definitely all of it.
Okay.
It's a hard thing to do. I think it's a hard thing to do well, and it's definitely a challenge for myself. But I feel like anybody can see when they walk into an art show, whether it's downtown Juneau or in Seattle or in New York, wherever you are, you can tell there's definitely an aesthetic like that's very pleasing to the eye, and some that are not. And you can tell it kind of definitely makes people react when pieces are put up haphazardly. As opposed to actually really thinking about setting up two different pieces of artwork next to each other and understanding what they do and how your reaction is to them. So all of that, yeah, goes into putting up a show.
In church art,
mm-hmm.
there's a thing called a triptych,
mm-hmm.
which is three paintings that are deliberately made in order
together.
To be displayed together. When you're creating art for your own shows, are you consciously thinking about how it's going to be mounted?
I think that's yes for some pieces and completely no for other pieces. It depends on, I think, your mindset when you're making the art. So when I think of triptych, especially religious triptychs in town, obviously I know Charles Rohrbacher, and so when he's creating a piece for a church, like a triptych for a specific space, then obviously you'll be thinking about that throughout the entire piece of art. And that could happen with any piece of art, really, in any show. But I think, at least for me personally, in my I do a lot of like figure sketches and drawings, and I'm not really thinking as much about the appearance of them in a gallery space until I'm actually in the space, and then start moving things around and understanding. And then I actually, usually when I'm setting up a show, realize that there's a space that's unused that needs a piece in it, and then I have to start being like, you know, I actually want to create a piece for that space.
Yeah, yeah. The children who created the art that's going to be in the All City Elementary Art Show didn't know where their art was going to be displayed or whether it was or not.
Yes, exactly.
So it, really the burden is very heavily on you. I mean, you're receiving all of this art. You've got to put it together in such a way that it makes sense to us.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. It's a pretty important thing to do. And it should be fun, though. I actually find I have a lot of fun doing it, and I find a lot of reward in setting up a show where you can really see how your impact can affect these pieces of art. And it's so fun to, I mean, I get to look at all the kids' art as well in full depth, so go through each of them and really recognize which ones are really, you know, are pretty incredible pieces and which ones can kind of offset those and have different effects on each other. So,
Everybody's going to get a chance to see your work as well as the children's work that gave you the work to do.
Yes.
Starting Monday, March 11th.
Yes.
And it runs through the end of the month. This is at the Nugget Mall. Doesn't cost anything. You just walk through the mall doing your normal shopping.
Yes.
And as you are taking that first stride down the hall and thinking, I've got to go this place and I've got to go that place, slow down. Slow down and take a moment to sniff the roses here, because this is the beginning of the Juno Arts community. These are the kids that will be up on the gallery walls in 5 years, 6 years, like that, after they go off and get their MFAs and come back and continue to contribute to our incredible, vibrant arts world that we have here in this little landlocked place that we live in. So thank you so much for all of the time that you must have put into this program, and thank you so much for telling us about the All City Elementary Art Show starting March 11th through the 28th at the Nugget Mall.
Yeah, thank
Giselle Stone,
thank you.
You're doing good. Keep it up. Let's see. We got a little appropriate piece of music here.
Mother brought him art supplies, suddenly before
It's just 10 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is here to tell us about the upcoming forum that the Joint World Affairs Council, or the Juneau World Affairs Council, will be running this week. And joining us by telephone is none other than Jim Clark. Hi, Jim.
How are you today?
I am just fine. So I understand you're doing a sort of a day-long or quite a lengthy forum, a two-day forum, called China in the 21st Century, The Pivot and the Sail. What's the significance?
That's exactly right.
What's the significance of the title, Jim?
Well, the significance of the title is that the pivot is, as you know, President Obama has talked about us as the United States pivoting toward the Far East, and the sail in the Far East that's causing us to pivot is China. And interestingly enough, when you take the anagrams that are used in China for to make the Chinese language, the pivot and the sail means China when you combine the two. So we thought that was interesting, and what we're really looking at is how China is going to continue to evolve, continue to grow and be important to not only the United States but the world in the 21st century as it comes of age and matures as a developing nation.
So the forum takes, or the I guess you're call is it a, it's a forum, yeah, okay. It's a two-day forum on Friday the 8th and Saturday the 9th of March. So it's this weekend starting at 7 p.m. Friday night with a keynote address by David Peets. And I don't have a great deal of biography on him. Can you tell us a little bit about your keynote speaker?
He's a Harvard-educated history professor from who's teaching at Washington State University. And what he's going to do is kind of set the stage for the entire forum. He's going to be speaking at the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS, as you said, starting at 7 o'clock. And what he's going to do is take us through modern Chinese history from 1911 up through the present. And, you know, there's just tremendous changes he'll be talking about from Sun Yat-sen to the nationalists and Chiang Kai-shek and the major confrontation between Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, which ended in Mao prevailing in the Chinese Civil War. And he'll walk us through the period of Mao's ascendancy and Deng Xiaoping's ascendancy to the collective leadership they have today. And we'll be looking at the, you know, the turnover in the leadership just occurred. The next step will be Saturday, when our speaker, Joe Bork, been the head for 15 years of the China-Washington Alliance, will talk us through what that change in leadership means for the United States. And it should be a very, very interesting discussion about what that change in leadership means and then what the experience of Washington has been in terms of trade relations with China. Ann Lee has written a book, What the U.S. Can Learn from China. And incidentally, that book will be available at the UAS bookstore. But she's going to be talking about that very thing. And then we've got a speaker named Robert Daly, who's really going to be making a talk. He's from the university. Be providing a talk on what makes China, China. And at the end of it all, we're going to have a panel.
Your phone is cutting in and out on a couple of things. Let me fill in the missing parts there. Looking at the material I have here, Robert Daly is part of the Maryland China Initiative at the University of Maryland.
That's correct.
He's the director of that program beginning in September of 2007. Okay. And so
he's
there,
got to talk about what makes China, China. I don't know if that clicked out when I when my phone was acting up there.
Yeah, it just momentarily did. Okay, so The Saturday events start at 9 o'clock in the morning. According to the poster, Ann Lee is the first speaker, and then Joseph Borish. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, and then David Peets is coming back to talk at 1:30.
Peets is going to come back. But David Peets' second talk will be very interesting because he's going to talk about engineering issues and environmental issues in China. And, of course, the gigantic dam that they built on the Yangtze part of his discussion of what the environmental problems and engineering problems associated with that meant to China. So I think for a lot of people that'll be just of special interest.
And then at 4:30, do all four of these speakers come together in the panel?
They do. And they'll converse among themselves about where they see China going in the 21st century. And then obviously we're going to open up all of this for questions for the audience. So we're really hoping that we'll get good student and faculty participation from the UAS and good community participation, as we always do, and a tremendous opportunity for people to ask questions and just learn what is happening in China these days.
Jim, this is an outstanding opportunity. So once again, just checking the times for sure. Friday night at 7 o'clock is David Peets' speech on the survey of modern Chinese history from 1911 to the present.
And that's in the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS. So
all of
right.
The events, I think, happen in the Egan Lecture Hall. Is that right?
They do. They're all in the Egan Lecture Hall.
And then Saturday, the event begins again at 9 o'clock in the morning with Ann Lee speaking about what the U.S. can learn from China. At 10:45, Joseph Borich, China-Washington Trade Development. At 1:30, David Peets returns with the environment and resources of China with a particular eye to engineering. And at 3 p.m., Robert Daly will talk about unified China theory, the classical roots of modern ambition. This all comes together at 4:30 with a panel that will be open for people to ask questions and participate in the discussion. The title of the panel discussion is What Can Be Expected in China-U.S. Relations and Trade Development Going Forward.
That's exactly right. And so we're really looking forward to that. And everyone's invited. And just remember, it's for free. And we're hoping the community takes advantage of this, what I think is a tremendous opportunity.
Well, I really hope they do, too, and thank you so much, Jim Clark, for coming on and telling us so that we can make our plans for this weekend. The event, again, starts at 7 o'clock on Friday night with David Peets' speech and then resumes again 9 and lends probably until around 5:30 or 6 on Saturday when the event will end.
Thank you so much for having us on.
An absolute pleasure, Jim. It's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, sir.
Bye now.
Bye now.
And a client has the show tomorrow. He'll be talking at Saturday's Bunko for Breast Cancer Research event. Laura Statz will come in to talk about the weekend's Youth Health Fair. A preview of tomorrow night's Alaska Design Forum presentation with Carla Ratti and the usual Wednesday update on Eagle Crest. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, I've been your host today and really enjoyed bringing you Juneau Afternoon. We are KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on a set of translators in the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can get our signal on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9.
The Juneau World Affairs Council presents a forum on China, The Pivot and the Sail, China in the 21st Century. Starting at 7 p.m. on Friday night, March 8th, at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, and continuing all day March 9th, the experts we're bringing to Juneau will discuss China today and where it is going in the 21st century. That's the evening of March 8th and all day on Saturday, March 9th at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, the Juneau World Affairs Council, bringing the world to Juneau.